environmental community, all of us that were fighting these very important principle battles, we got together and we said, let's address the driver of this predatory system. Let's get money out of politics. So we actually did that. We succeeded. We passed a referendum by a 2-to-1 margin in Massachusetts. And guess what happened? The legislature, overwhelmingly Democratic, about 85%, repealed campaign finance reform on a voice vote, actually, so that nobody could be held accountable for repealing it. And that's when I really became a confirmed Green, realizing that we've got to really, we need a political change if we are going to get every other kind of change that our lives literally depend on right now. And let me underscore why I get out of bed every day and I fight this with every breath that I have. And that is the understanding that came to me as an environmental health person, really interested in what's driving our epidemics of cancer and learning disabilities and asthma and diabetes. These are not God-given diseases. These are created by systems around us, our food deserts, the unaffordability of healthy food, the polluted air, and so on, the conflict and the social stress that has become commonplace, especially for low-income and communities of color who suffer the greatest health impacts of all. So I became very involved in fighting environmental racism, in particular coal plants and incinerators and toxic waste sites and things like that, which was sort of my door of entry into politics. When we lost campaign finance reform, I basically realized that one issue at a time was not going to get us there. The only way we were going to get there was by building basically political alliances, and that that needed to happen outside of politics as usual, outside of the corporate political parties that have been bought and paid for by the predatory banks and the fossil fuel giants and the war profiteers. Once again, we have seen another cycle of promised reform basically go bust. And what was done to Bernie Sanders, anybody here that was a Bernie Sanders supporter? Yeah, a lot of people. A lot of people got active and, you know, thank goodness for Bernie Sanders and how he helped empower a movement that refused to then sit down and shut up when Bernie Sanders got sabotaged by the Democratic Party. So double thanks to those of you who've been motivated and mobilized and who keep going. But what happened to Bernie happened to many people before him, including Dennis Kucinich, including Al Sharpton, including Jesse Jackson, going back all the way to the so-called realignment campaign of the Democratic Party, which took place in the 1960s and 70s. And the idea was, wow, we've got the civil rights movement, we've got the labor movement, let's take the power of these two movements and let's reform the Democratic Party. And you know how far they got? How far they got was to the war in Vietnam, because the war in Vietnam, which was strongly supported by the Democratic Party, you couldn't be a critic of that war and still have the credibility then to reform the Democratic Party. So what else is new? You know, the Democratic Party continues to be a major engine of this war machine, which is devastating us, devastating the planet. What we see going on now on the border of Russia, and particularly on the Korean Peninsula, is this this policy, this foreign policy of economic and military domination reaching its logical conclusion. That logical conclusion is a mushroom cloud, which is what we are rapidly heading towards. You take the regime change paradigm from the Middle East, you put it on the Korean Peninsula where there are nuclear weapons and where China and Russia are firmly entrenched, and it's not going to work, okay? So it's like the moment of truth now. Are we going to stay committed to this paradigm of economic and military domination that the Democrats, like the Republicans, are firmly committed to, with rare exceptions, but they're almost not to be seen right now at all or heard from? You know, it's that moment of truth. It's the moment of truth on climate. Are we going to be wedded to the good fossil fuels, as the Democrats have been pushing typically, which is fracking as opposed to coal? They're both deadly. And now we are seeing some movement, and the bill that Bernie Sanders is supporting would get us to 100% by 2050, but we can't wait till 2050. Jim Hansen just put out another paper basically confirming that the odds are diminishing to zero. There was another paper put out this week. I don't know if anybody saw it reviewed on the Real News Network. That's the only place I've seen it. About extinctions, about the sixth great extinction, which we are now firmly entrenched in. It's moving faster. This is what they always say. Faster than anybody expected. Well, I'd say who's anybody, you know? The anybody who expected it to not be very fast were the ones who have a vested interest in keeping the disaster going, you know? Some of us out here have been fully aware of where we've been going for decades, actually, and have been fighting it tooth and nail. The Green Party has been ahead of the curve. The curve is catching up to us in lots of ways, whether it's clean energy, equal marriage, living wages, free public higher education, ending student debt, bailing out the students like we bailed out the crooks on Wall Street. We can do that. It's about time. Instead of spending $1 trillion for a new generation of nuclear weapons, let's spend $1 trillion on a new generation of students and get them out of debt for once and for all. These are the kinds of things that we all agree on. The social movements are powering us. They are powering this political moment that we're in, this shifting political moment, and I think I'm about at the end of my time. This moment is a house of cards falling down, so we are rising up as it is falling down, and the more organized we are, the sooner that change is going to happen, and the greater our chances are of actually fixing these disasters that are barreling down on us, but which are eminently fixable right here and now. We need a Green New Deal, an emergency jobs program that will fix the economic crisis along with the climate crisis. We need a foreign policy based on international law and human rights. We need a right to a job at a living wage. We need health care as a human right for everyone, covers everybody, head to toe, cradle to grave, everybody in, nobody out. It doesn't cost us a penny more. It just moves healthcare dollars truly into healthcare. You know, we need a right to citizenship and a welcoming pathway for immigrants who are really the product of misguided U.S. policy for the most part, that is these wars, poverty, globalization like NAFTA, which displaced millions of farmers, regime change in South America as well as in the Middle East, that also sends people running here to our shores. So not fair to drive people here to save their lives and then criminalize them and then send them back to incredible danger from where they come. So these are fixable problems. They are problems that pay for themselves. And to just mention one thing, the Green New Deal makes us so much healthier from getting rid of the fossil fuels that are making us sick and their derivatives. We get so much healthier so quickly that the savings in healthcare alone has been shown to pay the costs of the green energy transition. So this is a win-win solution. This is an embarrassment of riches instead of this trajectory towards doomsday that we are barreling on right now. So bottom line is we can fix this. We have the solutions. We have the numbers. We have the power. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We are discovering that we have it, and we're discovering how we collaborate, whether that is in socialist alternative or whether it's in the Green Party. We're all getting together. Left Elect is the place where we're doing that. So I encourage you, get active locally in your social movements, in the political party that makes sense for you, and let's work together through Left Elect, and let's not take no for an answer. We will create an America and a world that works for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, hey guys, so my name's Chris Gray. I'm a member of Socialist Alternative. I'm Ginger's campaign manager. She's a city council candidate in Ward 3 in Minneapolis right now. And I've also played a leading role in the Fight for 15 in Minneapolis and a lot of other stuff in the city. I've been around for a little bit. And I just want to thank the Left Elect folks for inviting us to this session. We're really excited to join the other panelists as well and have this conversation with all of you. So just maybe to start with, I think one of the most urgent things we need to discuss in this country is how we can build a new fighting political alternative to take on Donald Trump and what he represents in the White House. Mm-hmm. That we have Jeff Sessions leading up as the Attorney General right now as an existential threat to Black Lives Matter. We have Ben Carson leading up HUD in Minneapolis. There's already a huge privatization of housing going on. That'll only get worse. And a climate denier at the head of the EPA. And to me, I think that shows the question is, what's the best force to fight back against that, and how can we construct that? And that's what excites me about building an independent political challenge, because I think that's central to that project. The corporate wing of the Democratic Party has proven time and time and again that it cannot put up an adequate resistance. Trump's Muslim ban was blocked by mass civil disobedience at airports, not by folks in Congress. And I think we can do it. I think Bernie Sanders shows that it's absolutely possible to achieve that. That a self-described socialist is now the most popular politician in the country, according to poll after poll after poll. And I think he stands to even have more influence with the debate around healthcare and his bold calls for taxing the rich, for Medicare for all, and a whole bunch of other things. And it's also noteworthy of where Bernie Sanders got support. It wasn't just liberal bastions and, you know, isolated places across the country, but Bernie Sanders won in West Virginia, in Harlan County, 2-1 over Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party primary. That county became later one of the highest vote counts for Trump in the country. And so you can see that even in places where we wouldn't expect, ideas like taxing the rich, like fighting the billionaire class, words like socialism are no longer a conversation ender. And I think that really shows the potential for what we can do. So yeah, I'm with Socialist Alternative. We're the organization that elected Shama Sawant in Seattle, supported Jill Stein's campaign for her president, spoken along many times. Shama was elected in 2013. 90,000 people in Seattle voted for a socialist in that election. It was a citywide election that time. And within 6 months, Seattle became the first city in the country to pass a $15 minimum wage. And that was a huge thing. Obviously, that's big in Minneapolis, where now we recently became the first Midwest city to do it. But it took a little bit longer because Minneapolis is run by the Democratic Party almost exclusively, with the exception of Cam Gordon, who's a Green Party member on the city council. And now Shama's taken on the fight against developers and issues like rent control. So the Seattle housing market is totally out of control. People's rent doubles every couple of years, and increasingly working class people are being priced out of the city. That's a really big fish to try to take on. Shama refuses to take money from developers very explicitly, fights unapologetically for issues like rent control. And I really agree with what Jill Stein was bringing up too as well, that only works if it's linked to social movements. So Shama passed a law called the Carl Hagelin Law. He's a slumlord in Seattle who is messing with his tenants. Shama used her office to organize with the renters to build a movement, not just against the landlord, but pass legislation. I think that's a model for how we can build independent politics. Also, I think it's noteworthy that Nikita Oliver and John Grant just made it through the primary. That what we're seeing in Seattle is actually a real resurgence of independents that are running and beginning to sort of take on some of the spirit that I think we've helped establish in Seattle. And I think that's not a surprise that that's in some places, with a few exceptions, that's where independent politics is growing really quickly. And Minneapolis needs a political alternative now. So if people read the article a couple days ago, this is now the most expensive mayoral election in the city's history, and we're 3 months away from election day. So $1.3 million is already in the mayor's race. It's really out of control when you think about it. I think in 2013 on election day, it was $500,000 in the mayor's race. And so it's big money going into Minneapolis politics. There's good reason for that. If you're a developer or a big business representative, we just passed 15 an hour here, and they have a lot at stake, and their profits are in danger. Also, there's massive development taking place in the city. Since 2009, rents have increased 15%, and the vacancy rate of apartments in Minneapolis is the lowest it's been in decades. So there's a housing crisis for working class people, and a very small group of people are making huge profits off of that. They're using some of that profit to try to control what's happening in City Hall. There's a deep crisis in the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm sure people are aware of that. It's been international news at this point. And it follows a whole string of crises between City Hall and the police department, mistrust and miscommunication that needs to stop. And I think the most recent murder of Justine Damon is just an example of the deep endemic problems in the police. Our police department union is headed by a widely believed to be racist, Bob Kroll. He's still the head of the union today. And it really shows that they're not planning on changing unless we can build something new, try to push forward bold ideas like ending stop and frisk policing in Minneapolis, like fighting for an independent mass community process to restructure the police department. We have no faith that people in City Hall can do it at this point after 4 years following Jamar Clark and countless other tragedies that have taken place. So I'm going to talk about Ginger. Ginger was the executive director of 15 Out Minnesota. She's also a member of Socialist Alternative. She's running as a socialist. It's very clear what our politics are. We believe capitalism is the problem, and we need to build an alternative to that. Ginger played a leading role in winning a $15 minimum wage here. It's just worth going into that a little bit because I think this is, most people would agree from around the country, Minneapolis is, dominated by the Democratic Party. Theoretically, they support 15 in their platform. They did it in 2014, but that didn't stop them from resisting the movement every step of the way. Up until the very, very end, finally they accepted it under pressure from below. And so, it's a model for we need to build movements, and those movements should develop a political alternative. We should have our own voice in City Hall who can fight for our issues. And I think what we're seeing, like Bernie Sanders, is it's viable to achieve that. And so we've been door knocking for 2 months now. We plan on a huge get out the vote operation in the fall. But lots of people are donating money to the campaign. There are folks around the country who are donating, and those are people who are excited about what's happening in Seattle, and they want to see this model built, right? And I think that also shows that we can do this in many other places as well. But even at the doors, when we bring up issues like rent control, that Ginger is not for sale, that she's not taking developer money from anyone, but what that means is that ordinary people need to get involved and get active in the process, otherwise we can't do this, right? We've gotten a really good response at the doors. And we're fighting to tax big developers and fund more affordable housing. It's an idea that's not being discussed in City Hall, something we want to put forward, and issues like rent control. There was just a Star Tribune article a couple days ago where renters had their rents arbitrarily increased. There's a grassroots movement built around them, and they're really fighting for that, but we need to bring that issue into City Hall as well. Social movements shouldn't be isolated and just left outside of what's happening. And I think we're really excited, too, in Minneapolis. It's really awesome that there's folks from the Green Party running as well. I think it's really, really key that there's a discussion outside of the Democratic Party that we can widen that out as much as possible, and I'm really excited to see that. I think we can build off that momentum and continue to do that as well. And Samantha's here as well. It's really excited. I'm going to wrap up with this. We live in a world where five billionaires control half of the world's wealth, and that's not sustainable. And there's an iceberg drifting off Antarctica that promises to raise global sea levels. And with Trump in the White House, with the people around him, with Congress, it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better. But it does seem clear that there's millions of people who want to fight back, that they're fed up with politics as usual, that they're prepared to organize, prepared to take highways, shut down airports if that's what it takes to fight back against Trump. And I think that that shows the foundation for how we can build genuine, independent, working class, and socialist politics in this country. So thanks.
And I would like to point out that Samantha Bree Stenson is our Green Party candidate here in Minneapolis. You can follow her. She's right at the forefront of all the local civil rights activities that have been going on. I had the honor of following her during a Philando Castile march, and she's an amazing leader. And I hope that you have some comments to make during our discussion that will explain to people more about you.
Thank you.
So now we're going to open the panel up to a question and answer session for about 20 minutes, and then open discussion for the last 15 minutes or so. Does anyone have any questions? Well,
yes.
We'll start with the lady in the back, and I believe that Samantha has a question as well. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Michael Hudson wrote a book called Beating the Host, Devouring the Host, about the need for us to really change our whole financial system, the monetary system. And I'm wondering if you all could talk to if you see that need, what you think needs to happen so that money is no longer owned privately by banks, and also how that would apply, if there's any way to speak about the role of banks and money and financialization in local races.
anyone like to take a stab at that?
Sure. So, you know, banks and monetary policy are kind of this hidden infrastructure that determines a whole lot. And the way that money is created now creates a lot of debt when money gets spent into the economy. And I am not an expert on this issue at all, so let me just put a lot of caveats around it. But what I will say is that we pay a huge amount of money just in the public sector because of the way that money is generated. And if our finance was coming from a public bank, like North Dakota has, the burden of debt on public projects, which can amount to half the cost of, say, building housing or building, you know, transportation systems, there is a huge debt burden that goes with that. And my understanding from people like Ellen Brown, who's one of the people that talks a lot about public banking, which, by the way, is a local issue, and I'll come back to that in a second, but by changing the way that money is created, by creating public ownership over our banks, by making banking a public utility and changing even the way that we define and create money, we can create a whole world of possibilities that is very real and concrete. So in terms of local agendas, fighting for a state public bank or even for a community public bank, it's been very hard to move this forward, but there are many commissions that are going, that are exploring this at the local level and at the state level. And, you know, we need to keep pushing, I think, to make this happen, because when it does, it's a whole new ballgame. We have a much more stable financial system, and it's far less predatory. Right now, you know, you have predatory banks which are making out like bandits, and it makes the whole economy insecure, and it imposes an incredible tax burden on all of our public endeavors. So there's enormous room to move forward, and there are some very good there's very good information out there on this on our Green News Network, by the way, which is just my social media site. It's Dr. Jill Stein, I think, at Facebook. We've had some very knowledgeable people on the Green News Network talking about monetary policy and what it means for us as communities as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ginger is not here to speak. You're speaking on her behalf. Too. Would you like to address the issues regarding banking on her behalf, or...
I can pass this, right? Is that okay?
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't know we were going to go down the line.
Okay.
I'll say, anyone from Minnesota, there is currently a bill in the House to establish a public bank in Minnesota. Okay. So that's good news. It's probably going to need a lot of work before it gets passed. But with respect to, I mean, I spend a lot of time with groups talking about economics, modern monetary theory, Austrian economics, the history of banking in the U.S., it's something you could talk about for hours. I generally, when I engage with people, try to keep it fairly simple. I speak in terms of the migration of wealth. This is the influence of corporate money in our economy and in our politics. And most people see it in their rents. Chris was saying, and that rings very well with most people. They feel it. From the lowest class to the upper class. And thank you very well for stating those issues very eloquently, Jill and Chris. But that's how I generally present it. If people want to know more, then we can go deeper, but it can get very complicated. I agree with the issue of public banking, and that's what I would support as a monetary movement.
Okay, Samantha was next, and it looks like there's a number of hands over this way. I see everyone who has their hands raised.
And just real quick, too, there is, if you guys are from here and you don't know, there is a movement for a Black credit union on the north side, but it's not just for Black money, it's for all of our money, and it's a step in the right direction. So all you have to do is pledge, and it requires absolutely no money. I would encourage you to make the pledge so we can make it happen.
Yeah.
Once it happens, we can continue to build services, and it's a step in the right model of moving to, in our city, having something that's localized so that our dollars stay within our community. Because when our dollars we spend stay in, we're able to build wealth in the areas where we have gap.
Website?
I will share it with Jill. I can look it up before we leave too and make sure you all have it.
And we can post it on our on our Facebook page.
And spread it.
Yes.
But my question is a question and a comment. Paula, I don't know if you said it because I missed your piece, but you both said something very key in which you said the key is social movements. But what we need to be careful of and very sensitive to is not to tokenize the social movements, to use those movements to get what we want, because then we're doing the same thing that the other side is doing. And what we've seen time and time again is a lot of these social movements are primarily built around the people that are on the margins, or as I like to say, in the median, because we're halfway there, but we're trying to get through all that traffic to the other side. So these communities, primarily women of color, a lot, indigenous women, it's really been a lot of women, have been the ones doing the organizing. But what we've seen through news and media and other ways is we end up getting erased out of that history somehow. And then the group or the organization takes the credit for the work that actually was built on the back of others. So we have to be very careful, especially as we're talking about democracy. We need to make sure that we have people that are representative of actually running these movements and organizing these movements to make sure that they have a space to not just be a community organizer. Because that's right. Usually the space that we've been pushed into. You're a community organizer. But when it comes to stepping out of that role to leading for a broad group of people, you notice there's not a lot of people that look like me in this room. The capability question comes in, where can I bridge that gap to go from being the community organizer to being the leader who's actually driving the change, that's leading the movement from the position of power? So that's kind of my challenge and my question on how do you intend to avoid that? As you're talking about social movements are the key to moving this, how do you intend on making sure that you don't miss that mark? Because especially in Minneapolis, we see a lack of this. We've had one Black mayor ever. That's abysmal. We've never had a Black woman in a color, a woman of color in the seat that I'm running for. But we've had many firsts. We're still seeing firsts. We just had the first Latina when Alondra Cano was elected. So here in our city, we still have too many firsts for my liking and taste. And what are we going to do about it as we're talking about building a democracy so that we can avoid continuing to erase these people out of history?
Thank you. Thank you, Samantha. Okay, I saw the fellow in green and a fellow in the white, and the very far corner, another green jacket.
Deanna, do you want us to respond?
Would you like to respond?
Yeah.
Okay, can you hold your questions just until they respond? Sure. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean,
could you stand up, please?
Oh, sorry. Maybe standing up a bunch. No, it's absolutely right. The Democratic Party co-opts social movements in Minneapolis. And tries to bring it in to get momentum for themselves. And so one of the biggest, with 15 an hour in Minneapolis, the city hall, Mayor Hodges opposed that the entire way through publicly and privately. And then it's like under a lot of pressure from below, especially earlier this spring, everybody woke up in city hall and decided that now they support 15 an hour. And now they're the same folks who are saying, we're the ones who passed it. But City Hall did not pass 15 an hour. They technically voted on it, but it took building a real movement from below to try to make that happen. And I really agree. The Democratic Party are experts at taking that momentum, pulling it behind folks who don't deserve that momentum all the time, and they're not accountable. In 2013, Mayor Hodges was compared to Bill de Blasio and Shama Sawant in Minneapolis as someone who is elected to address Minneapolis's worst in the country racial and economic inequalities. And since then, what little progress has been made towards that goal has been pushed to the front by grassroots organizing and absolutely from organizers of color, women of color in the movement. And I think that's absolutely relevant, and we want to try to transform that as well. So,
yeah. Outside of $15, too, I just want to point out, because that was kind of outside of what the point I was making.
Really?
Okay. What are we going to do to sure that we're not tokenizing people of color and allowing them to be able to move into positions such as city council, such as governor, and other things, how are we going to avoid using them only to fuel the new movement, but not to lead it proper?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that's a really critical issue. And I'll say during our presidential campaign, you know, which we ran as a black and white ticket, it was very important to have the leadership of the African-American movement grounded in the community, not grounded in big money in the Democratic Party, constantly leading the charge. And really, our goal, you know, and why we developed the Green News Network and all that was to be able to bring the voices of the front lines community into the front lines of political dialogue so that it wasn't us speaking for anybody, but rather that we used our political assets in order to lift up the voices of struggle, the struggle for, you know, for Black Lives Matter or for ending deportations or for anti-environmental racism. Let the movement speak for itself. And the outcome of that is that we now have so many candidates of color that are running in the party, which I consider like a real validation of the party's service to the frontline movements. So in New York City, for example, our slate, we have a fabulous slate of about 6 or 7 candidates who are almost entirely people of color. Same thing in Detroit. Detroit, which has been in the belly of the beast of the Democratic Party, because in part because we were a real presence in the recount and because of Detroit's sensitivity to the stealing of their elections for many years, a whole bunch of people have moved over from the Democratic Party now and are running as Greens, including for city clerk, which is basically in charge of how elections get run. And, you know, this is a trend we're seeing all over the country, that so many, I would say, national quality candidates who are terrific, including yourself, really fabulous candidates who are really ready for prime time, have been given support and given basically a position to say, here, you know, we're here to support you. You're representing the core of the agenda that we share. Take it away. And this is a very intensive dialogue going on right now in the Green Party as to how do we best optimize the leadership of the communities of struggle. And I think it's a very creative struggle, myself, that's going on inside the Green Party and its national committee. And in fact, you know, a number of national committee members resigned after the steering committee election because there were not a new crop of African Americans elected. So some people stepped down in order to make room. And, you know, I think there are very healthy movements and actions taking place right now to ensure that you know that communities of struggle are leading the way to solving these crises, because that's who has to lead the way.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry. Can we repeat the premature? We're running out of time. We still have questions.
You're not
going to
let me respond to that.
Well, if it takes
10
minutes, we can.
You're not going to let
your
the
slate
first.
Until 2:15.
The first. So. I am one of those firsts, right?
Yeah.
I have to respond
right.
to
that.
I was selected by the DFL party as a delegate at large because I was one of those marginalized or underrepresented groups. I was chosen by the DFL party to reach out to those groups, and I did reach out to those groups, and my conclusion was, after a couple of years, and was, we need our own party. And not just one big party, but multiple parties that do, in fact, work together on common cause. And I hear my independent friends saying, well, I look at the candidates, I'm an independent, I make a personal judgment. I said 300 million us, me's, do not make an us. And if you're not connecting with someone or some group or some movement, then you're not participating in democracy. Thank you.
So the gentleman in the green up front.
Sure. So I wanted to ask, my question is about building coalitions among multiple parties and different groups.
what is the largest obstacle to building coalitions, and how does Left Elect address that?
Anybody want to jump in, or I can?
Could you repeat that?
What are the largest obstacles toward building coalitions among multiple left parties or social movements, and how does Left Elect address that?
Fear, anxiety, prior learning.
Distrust.
So that's principally what I do, is work with minor parties to build a minor party coalition. A lot of it centers around ballot access and the ability to attract candidates and run candidates. It's very, very difficult to run in our political system, particularly if you're going for a state office, virtually impossible if you want to go for a federal office, which is why I run at that level, because that's where I'm organizing at that level, around political reform. But minor parties have, I mean, there's a competition there, right? We're used to winner-take-all politics. We treat it like it's some kind of contest, a football game. One team has to win and the other team has to lose. And that's not the way it needs to be. I think Jill Stein has addressed that very eloquently. It's a win-win situation. And so it's a lot of conversation. I spend a lot of time working with a lot of people, understanding what their issues are, finding out what their commonalities are, and helping those common purposes rise to the surface. I mean, money and politics is certainly one that just about everybody will latch onto right away. There's still ambiguity about what we exactly mean by that. But it's overcoming a lot of poor learning that we've gained through a very poor political process that we've been dealing with for decades. So it's unlearning what we've learned about democracy and learning new principles. I hope that answers your question.
Can I add something real quick, just from having worked with Left Elect since it began about 2 years ago? The issue of trust is exactly right, but I think one of the ways that we build trust, in addition to talking, is by doing. And some of us found who were working together on the Global Climate Convergence, which was this effort to organize around the climate summit in New York in 2014, we were working together, and then we forgot what party we belonged to. You know, we were just like doing the work. And when you're doing that, you kind of build a much stronger bridge. So I think, again, it comes back to working on the social movements and being grounded in them, being grounded in the frontline communities whose struggle really, I think, is the glue. It's really the glue of courage, the glue of commitment and vision. The other thing I wanted to say is that what really set Left Elect back, believe it or not, was the Bernie Sanders campaign, because we were kind of all moving towards independent politics. And then the Bernie thing came along, which gave a lot of people doubts. And it was, well, maybe I should give the Democratic Party another chance, which a lot of people did. And it basically busted the opportunity to develop a real independent challenge in 2016. And I just want to stress that, because that's going to happen again and again. This is how the playbook works. They dangle out in front of us some really appealing progressive candidate, mm-hmm. and then they take out the kill switch at the last minute, and they sabotage that candidate, and we're right back where we started. And then there are all these promises that, oh, just stick with the Democratic Party because we're going to reform the DNC and we're going to do all these great things, which of course doesn't happen. And then they obstruct, and Nancy Pelosi puts out her talking points on single-payer health care. I should say her talking points on the Trump health care bill, which says don't mention single-payer. You know, it's like everything but talking about the solution. And the Democratic head of the assembly in California removes it, takes single-payer off the table at a time when it's about to pass the second house in the legislature. So same old, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, fool me 1,000 times, really shame on me. Let's not go there at a time especially that we are dangling, you know, our survival is really hanging in the balance right now.
and we have limited time to really change this. The last point I want to make is that the solution here, I think, you know, who do we trust? Who do we go with? Do we work with progressive Democrats who are really sincere? In my view, what has been useful in sorting the wheat from the chaff is the question of whether or not they accept corporate money. Because if they accept corporate money, then that money invariably comes with strings attached.
That's
whether
right.
they are explicit or whether they're unspoken, that money creates certain obligations. And if a political entity or a candidate has the conviction to say no to corporate money, then you can be pretty sure that what they say is what they're going to do. And that's who we want to be working with. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you very, very much. I'd like to ask the panel, can we start keeping the answers down to about a minute?
Can you?
We're running out of time.
Yes.
We have a lot of questions.
Give us a
shout
out when we
okay.
get
okay.
that
Thank you. I know there's so much information. It's so
got politicians at the table.
The gentleman in the...
yeah, the theme for the World Social Forum 4 years ago in Tunisia was fight and build. And it seems like with Trump, we've entered into this great mode of fight, fight, fight. And so we have struggles after struggle after struggle. But what are you doing in terms of the build part? How do we build an alternative, and what does that alternative look like?
Samantha? I know she's been doing a lot of the coalition building as well.
Yeah.
Did you have anything to say towards that question?
Well, you just have to talk about what the real, you have to be willing to talk about what the real issues are. And for so long, we've had people that only want to talk about what they think people want to hear. But I will tell you, most of the time, I'm going out, and in my ward, it's more of an affluent ward. It's kind of a mix. There's a lot in my ward. I'm mostly in front of rooms full of people that look pretty much like this, little bits, sprinklings of diversity in there. But when I say what I say, they get excited and they clap. They just haven't heard anybody willing to say it. So we have to realize that we have to all stop playing safe and realize that there are more of us that want to be having these conversations, but we have to be brave, and somebody has to start talking first. And then you realize, as you start talking to your friends and your neighbors and your colleagues, how many of you are actually on the same page. And as I was saying this morning in the session I led, we have to be willing to start the conversations from a point of sameness. We already know where we differ, and we're not going to agree, and we're not going to change each other's minds. When we start from that, it goes nowhere. But when we can establish what's similar about us, whether that's that we're both parents, we have kids in school, whatever it might be, when you start the conversation from there, there's something that you both relate to, and therefore you're able to start the conversation from there. And when you hit the differences, you're more willing and likely to be able to work with through those together, because you've already established what you're cool on with each other, right? So we have to start getting out of this mindset of already coming out with the talking point of where we know that it's different. So when it comes to building the coalitions to me doesn't mean that we're all in agreement. Conversation should never be about agreement. Conversation is about gaining mutual perspective. And how do we use that to move forward? And like I said, I didn't wake up this morning to move left or right. I don't know about you. I woke up to move forward with my day. The only way that we're able to do that is to stop thinking with this left mind, right mind, Democrat, moderate, liberal, conservative, progressive, yak, 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 yak. It goes on. And all of us start to be conscious. When we start to become conscious, we're aware of the conditions that led to where we are, your question, and we're able to move forward and actually build these coalitions, which means we're operating under a sameness, which is the system is broken. We all agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
We start the conversation there. Then that's how we move forward, and that's how we build the coalitions.
Thank you.
I
would say, 1 minute, please. Thank you.
I would say for me, I would go with Bob Newhart's advice. If it hurts, stop doing that. And the first step for me is to stop voting for Democrats and Republicans. I understand progressive movements. I supported John McGovern when I was a teenager. Most of you probably don't remember who that was. Okay, yeah. I've been around progressive movements all my life. After Bernie Sanders, I said, that's it. Okay, stop beating my head against the wall.
Yeah.
And the next step is just get involved anywhere. Any movement, any political party, and we're all going to start working together.
And I'll just add, you know, on this question of how are we building? You know, we're fighting. There are lots of independent fights, which there need to be. That's why, you know, a political party, a real political party, is a coalition of movements that are going to stay together around an explicit agenda over time. So it's not just here today for the demonstration and then gone tomorrow. We're here with the agenda, we're going to keep working on it, and we can reach critical mass. That's why I think translating this resistance into building political parties that are independent of the big corporate capitalist machine is really critical, whether it's Socialist Alternative or Green Party, and us working together. You know, political parties is how we build power for the movements, and we also give the movements traction. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. Mm-hmm. Never has, never will. So we have to take that demand, we have to take it into the halls of power, challenge power, and take power, and that's how we change things.
Chris?
I mean, yeah, I agree with what's been said. Bernie, I think watching Bernie's campaign was both incredibly frustrating, but also showed the outlines of what's potential, that millions of people are prepared to support a clear program, an alternative to the corporate parties, to Wall Street, to for-profit healthcare. I could go down the list. I think the biggest crime there, absolutely, yes. The biggest crime there is that all of that momentum got pushed back into the DNC and the Democratic Party, and it feels lost. But I think there is a one-to-one connection between the momentum and energy and enthusiasm behind Bernie's campaign and the fact that people after Election Day were willing to join Socialist Alternative in Minneapolis and go march on I-94 in protest of Trump's election. I think there is a connection there, and I think it will go back into the electoral arena as well, and it's up to us to try to capture those folks and bring them in, and I absolutely agree.
Thank you. The fellow in the back with the green blazer.
The other fellow in green asked almost exactly the thing I was going to say.
Okay. And the lady in the blue has been raising her hand
for quite
a bit.
Well, my name is Allison Renville. I'm a senior project member, and I have spent the majority of my last year not only learning how to be a water protector, but learning how to be an ally to non-natives and to non-people of color. So my question is how are we to effectively empower non-native people to be better allies without kind of emphasizing the racial divide? Because, you know, it's not that we're encouraging you to do anything on behalf of all white people, but at what point in time is it the responsibility of white people to educate and, you know, help other white people become more sensitive as human beings? Because the colonization is deep. You know, I mean, they've only been doing it to us for 500 years, but you guys have been going for centuries, you know? So, I mean, like, how do we encourage and help confidently uphold your role as an ally or, you know, as an accomplice? Like, you, Dr. Stein, you know, you came to Stand Rock and got arrested with us. You know, there was a point in time where we were talking to people, talking to non-natives and saying, well, you should be arrested today. Because that's where it made a difference. It, you know, Indians get arrested every day. We all know this. People of color get arrested every day. It's very unlikely that you're going to find over 100 white people getting arrested at one time. But that's the kinds of stuff that makes a difference. You know, and I mean, there were people who came in with the intention of standing up for us, but we wanted to stand with us. So now how do we effectively help non-Native people become better allies? And how do we encourage white folks like yourself to have that conversation with your peers in order to create that conversation where everyone can become more aware and educate themselves? Because there's a lot of people of color who are trying to heal. And white people can heal too. You know, I mean, the suicide rates and the alcoholism only rises in your statistics as you get older. And it actually diminishes with people of color. We're alcoholics and everything in high school. And, you know, we get all that out of our system, and then we grow up to be healthy people and we live a really long time.
I'm willing to respond to that question, and I may not be giving you exactly the answer you want to hear. I certainly have the same question around trans allies, right? How do we get people to be better trans allies? And not to compare our situation with the horrible devastation of the indigenous populations, mm-hmm. But I do think that part of the solution, of course, is telling our stories. White people need to know just exactly what we did to the indigenous people. And we need to start assuming ownership of that. And I hear people today still saying, well, I can't do anything about that. I wasn't there in 1800. But the fact is, it's still going on. And we're not talking about it. We're not hearing it. And that's a big part of it, is that we need to start sharing those stories. And would it be wonderful if people would all go out and educate themselves about everything that they need to know? That would be fantastic. And we have those discussions in the trans community, too. But ultimately, we need people within our community that are willing to bring those messages forward. So some of the responsibility does lie with us. We need more Indigenous people to run for office or lead movements. The Dakota Access Pipeline, I think, was very instrumental in educating a lot of people. The statue over at the Art Park in Minneapolis was very instrumental in educating people.
The next question.
So,
right. And thank you very, very much for your response, Paula. We want to get a couple more in the afternoon.
No problem. We need a timekeeper.
Go ahead.
So the 2020 election's 3 years away, and we're going to be in the midst of that in 3 years. So what is, and we're going to end up with the same middle-of-the-road Democrat, probably against Trump, maybe not, who knows. But so what's the strategy to make this third party, whether it's Greens or whoever, whatever it is, viable enough so that enough Democrats and independents can move over so that it could really make a difference? Otherwise, it's just going to be the same old with, I don't know, 5% Green, 45, 40, 50, whatever. So what's the strategy? We've got 3 years. What are we going to do in 3 years to make a third party really viable?
I can do that again. Sure, yeah. That's the question. Yeah, absolutely. It's really important. I mean, I think it starts with what's happening this year. We're in cities across the country. There are independent challengers running that are typically dominated by the Democratic Party, and I don't think that's unique to Minneapolis or Seattle, but this could be done across the country. And I think what we see is that these candidates can be viable, and it's possible to do that, and I think we can scale that up at different levels of office, and that's absolutely necessary. I also think that the clear lesson of 2016 was you don't fight Donald Trump with corporate politics, right? And there were lots of working class people even who supported Trump, even though his agenda is billionaire backed and completely against their interests, because in a distorted way, he did represent an alternative to politics as usual. And that's terrible. We can't let that happen again.
No.
We need to put forward a very clear argument that you don't fight Trump with corporate politics. You fight Trumpism with independent left-wing politics and a clear alternative vision for how things should work in society, with living wages for all. And just to connect to the Standing Rock thing really just super briefly, I don't think it's also true that there's Standing Rock and Flint, the crisis there happening at the same time. And I think that there are potentials for connections. It doesn't mean that they're the same struggle, but I think it's a way of talking about the issue, too, that this is an issue that impacts all sorts of folks.
And in my own opinion, I mean, it shows, you know, the capabilities of the American government to leave people behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the consultations in Standing Rock didn't even happen. You know, I mean, they left a voicemail, and that was it. Sent an email. That was it. They never had any follow-up, no nothing. And then in Flint, they're running around doing all of this stuff, leaving all of these people of color behind. So, I mean, like, they are the same. It is the same. We all know that. But how do we encourage white people to acknowledge this, you know?
Well, I mean, we're at the start of a movement here, right?
Okay.
Right? We're at the start of a movement here. Trump is just a symptom of the problem.
Okay, the lady in the white, and then the lady in the green, and
Jill
then the lady in the black.
About the response of the question.
Well, do we have time? No, we don't. So I'd like to get some more questions in, because this is the question and answer session.
She's got to speak. May I just recommend that we do have a timekeeper.
Yeah, we should have a timekeeper.
Time so that everybody does have a chance to
speak. Thank you. That's what we're trying to do, is allow everyone a chance to speak.
Could someone in the front row just be a timekeeper?
I need
a
timekeeper.
Okay, yeah, thank
is
you.
Is it going to?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, you know, one thing that really annoys me is that disabled people are not being covered in this, and I think it's abysmal that we don't have enough disabled people in public office, especially disabled people that are whose disabilities are visible.
you know, especially those who are out of the closet who say what disabilities that there are, you know, that they have. And I plan on running against Amy Brenda Bowen here in St. Paul in 2018, you know, on the city council. Happens to have epilepsy, and this, you know, while this conference did a good job of mentioning saying ableism once on the page 46 of under overcoming oppression and building an inclusive democracy movement, there hasn't even been one workshop talking about ableism. Nothing. I'm real unhappy about that.
Thank you. So
far the healthcare movement, has shown, it's, hand holding, hand stretched its hand out towards the disability community.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for raising that. It's a very important issue, and I'm sure it's well received by the panel. Unfortunately, we don't have time for a lot of rebuttals. We want to get in all the questions and the issues that maybe the panel can take into account.
Okay.
When we're selecting,
you
three news
members.
You
hear a bunch of questions, and then we'll,
sure.
And then we'll go down and respond to all of them.
Yes, my question is, why don't we hear politicians talking about empathy?
About what?
Empathy. Putting ourselves in other people's shoes. I think you can reach a large swath of people if you talk about empathy and start naming off the things that we should be sharing feelings about other people, not just ourselves.
Thank you. I agree. Very true. I see another question by the window, and the lady in the black has been waiting a long time. I'm so sorry. Go ahead. And then we'll do the window. Okay.
In terms of building coalitions, why can't we all, come together on single payer? You know, there's a lot of, people who voted for Trump that would totally get behind that, too. This needs to be something that we all come together on, no matter if you're Democratic, Socialist, you're Green Party, you're Draft Bernie, whatever it might be. I think that that's really the way that we will bring everybody together. It's not going to be about race. It's not going to be about any of those things. It's going to be about we all, want our children to survive. I'm a single mom of a baby, and I want him to have a good life. You know, we need a new deal. We need a green new deal.
Thank you. And the lady by the window.
Yeah, I think that's a super important point. There is the real potential in the U.S. to shoot at polls about how popular, for example, single payer is. There is a real potential to build a mass movement around it, I think, right now. I think the issue, an issue that's coming up here a bit, is about how to hold candidates and politicians accountable. And we can know that, getting into office doesn't automatically mean somebody's going to fight for working people, even if they say that in their campaign trail. And the issue, similarly, for accountability in movements is really important, especially on the left. If the left is weak and there's not building accountability in it, real power, it leaves open the space for the right, which we just saw with Donald Trump taking office. I think the example of Shama Sawant is super crucial for that, to show that the concrete ways that she continues to be accountable in movements and organization, which she is the first one to say that that's crucial for her power. And accountable to working people. And you can see that, for example, in one way where she continuously claims and follows through on only taking the average worker's wage and the rest of social movements. And I know Ginger.
Thank you.
Anyway, Ginger thank also you. Makes that claim. And I think
that's
really
thank you. Thank you. Okay, were there any more questions? Can our panel respond to the. Okay. One more question?
Two comments. I think we have to be willing to show that the Democrats do not have the solution to Trump. Mm-hmm. We have too many people who are mad at Trump, and therefore they turn to the Democrats who just sell us out. We're going to win over the Tea Party if we're willing to attack the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And for people in the Twin Cities, the BDS community, which is supporting BDS and supporting Palestinians, is having a conference on October 21st. I got flyers, I'll put them up here. It's Parallel Liberation Struggles, Palestinian, Native American, and Black American Similarities in the Struggle. And it'll be a chance to bring communities together, and I'll put them up on the table. People can get.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. October 21st.
I have a suggestion as far as getting it out, getting word out, because I think a lot of people don't know about the new party. And so I have a suggestion, and that is, I think TV and videos, those kind of things work. If the time is bought now before the election season goes into full throttle, and it can be 30 seconds, and the shorter the better, because the point of the commercial could be that we don't have corporate money. We don't have a lot of money like these other people who can run ad after ad after ad. But this is what we're about, single payer, someone mentioned. We are not funded by corporations. That will, I'm with Move to Men. When we tell people we're, you know, tell them about, no corp, you know, get rid of corporations as people, they are for it. Like, you know, they
yes.
sometimes grab it from the inside. It's such a popular notion. But just some of those key things, and then a website where you can find out who it is in your place. Keep up that website with the people in your area. And I just think there's not enough. I don't even have a TV, but
it's not getting out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Someone in the back. There's one more person.
Okay. Second question. I'm wondering about the international situation and the seven countries now that we're bombing.
Yes.
And the way that America has traditionally divided and conquered. And when I see the people in Iraq, or the people in Yemen, or the people in Israel, I see us just down the road a little way. So what I'm wondering is, how do we expand our view to include the people who are now going through what in several years we ourselves may be going through in terms of divide, conquer, and absolutely suppress?
Thank you. Okay, and if there are no more questions, I believe our panel can close with 1 minute speeches each, please. And we'll be free.
I was going
to. I still have some time if you want
okay.
I'll just do this because I don't want to take time.
Thank you.
1 minute. Let's see. Can I propose that we take 2 minutes each?
Yeah.
It'll delay us a little bit.
If you
don't
come throw us out of here, we can take the afternoon. I'd be happy.
If you want to hold us accountable, we need at least 2 minutes.
Okay. I have it set to 2 minutes. Chris, are you going first?
I can do that. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm still writing down some of the questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I really appreciate everyone for coming to this session in the conference, and if people are from out of town, welcome to Minneapolis. I hope you stick around for a while. There's a lot of exciting campaigns taking place in the city that folks should get involved in today. And I think, the discussion about 2020, right? How are we going to defeat Donald Trump? How are you going to defeat Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell? And I think it should be framed that way. That's the question my mom's asking right now. She's not asking, she wants to know, what can I do? And I think it is true. We should say, you should get involved in organizing. The next time there's a shooting, you should be out on the streets. The next time there's a Muslim ban, you need to be at the airports. That's actually the vehicle that has transformed society. But I really agree with the points that other folks have raised. And I think that's the other key side, is that if those movements don't develop their own independent political expression, time and time again, the Democratic Party, predominantly in urban centers especially, co-opts those movements and uses it to get their people elected. And what we're seeing in Minneapolis is there's a lot of talk about affordable housing, about police reform. And then the same people who say that take money from big developers. And so I think we need to be absolutely clear that we are building something that is not powered by corporate money or big developers. It's powered by ordinary people and small donations. That is not just nice words, but it's accountable to a clear program that people have decided in advance, and that candidates are rooted in that. I think that's the way we fight Trump. I think we need to build movements. I think locally, especially this year, there's huge opportunities across the country. What's happening in Minneapolis and in Seattle is not unique. We could be doing this in many other places and really build up towards momentum to 2020. And I think the key discussion will be, we need to, you don't fight Trump with corporate politics. I fight Trump with socialist politics, in my opinions, but I don't think it's exclusive to that. I think Bernie shows that clear left-wing program, no corporate money, and a genuine track record for standing on the issues is the best way to defeat Donald Trump and rebuild the independent left politics.
Thank you.
Okay, moving down the line. Really great questions. Great session. Thanks to everybody for being a part of this. Thank you, Deanna, for organizing it.
I wish there was time to go down those questions one by one because they're all really good and important, but to try to maybe hit some of the underlying themes here. In terms of 2020, you know, it's really important that we build movements and that we build a political structure to fight those movements. I worry that if we're just going out to the latest demo or if we're just organizing to defeat Trump, we easily get diverted back into the trap, well, Hillary Clinton is the answer to Trump. You know, she's the next strongest thing,
right,
et cetera. So I hesitate myself. I hesitate to organize just around Trump. Trump is a symptom of a deeper disease. He is part of the sickness himself, but he's also a symptom of the sickness. And, you know, these questions about war, I think, are really critical as healthcare, as human rights, and the power of those struggles. And let me just say that I think those struggles are sort of the cure for what ails us. They are the courage, they are the vision, they are the incredible conviction, which is contagious. They have a power of their own, they need to be heard. We need to be talking to the white supremacist community ourselves, which is a critical part of this, but it's both ingredients. Those stories have a power of their own. They are the glue that holds us together. We also need to build a political vehicle, because this question, are we going to target 2020 and are we going to start now? Or are we prioritizing local elections? You know, I myself feel like we cannot give them a pass at the highest national level, because then they just proceed with impunity to keep doing what they're doing, and we don't have very much time left. This is that Hail Mary moment. It's really a time for us to stand up and to, you know, to forget the lesser evil and fight for the greater good. And if we do our work and we create electoral reform, then we don't have to be put into the lesser evil bind to start with. We need ranked choice voting. We need access to the ballot. We need to get money out of politics. The bottom line for me is let's organize politically, because then we can be strategic about how we use our time and our energy, and we can have a plan that we all agree on and that we get to work on as soon as possible. Thank you.
I do want to address the issue of ableism quickly, because I do think we do need to listen to all voices. Again, I think a lot of it revolves around the idea of telling stories. I used to think that I was not a prejudiced person or a biased person. I think most of us feel that way about ourselves until I really started examining myself. I used to work downtown, and there were a lot of people with disabilities. And one day I decided, well, you know, I'm just walking by these people with my blinders on. I'm not really paying attention to them. And so I decided to talk to one of the gentlemen, and I think he had cerebral palsy or something. I couldn't understand a word he said, and it's like, my Lord, what have I done? I'm not prepared for this. But over time, every day, he was really glad to see me. And over time, I did gradually begin to be able to communicate with him. So it's good. We need to stop treating people like charity cases and start listening to what they need. As far as politicians empathizing, that's all they do. Republicans, Democrats appeal to a nurturing, compassionate family model. Republicans appeal to a disciplinary family model. It's all based on family relationships that we're familiar with. I would recommend George Lakoff if anyone wants to learn more about political messaging. It's pretty ugly, actually, the way they've implemented it. With respect to single payer, it does illustrate how complicated and subversive political messaging can be. What you're hearing now is Medicare for all. Well, that's a horrible way to move forward. But it's politically expedient because it's something we're familiar with and something that works and something we want. But it's not something that's going to scale to every 300 million people. We have a whole mishmash of healthcare policies. We need to improve access and reduce costs. And I've been supporting single payer since the beginning of my campaign. But it does illustrate the complexity of political messaging. As for candidates accountable, that's one of my number one issues. I believe in candidate forums. I believe in town halls. I believe that we should be demanding these things. We have candidates that absolutely will not appear in public. So I'm out of time. But thank you so much. That's a relief. Thank you so much for being here.
I liked it, the green symbol from Hitler.